First one, the first two work made in collaboration with Augusto Sagnotti, and the last one in collaboration with the postdoc in Scuola Normale, Jan Jung. And I will talk basically of three-point function, and then I will try to mention at the end if I manage also something of higher, so endpoint functions for higher spin in flat space and also in constant curvature backgrounds. So let me start by making some introduction about the higher spins and basically introducing the motivations for that, that actually are at base, at the basis of this kind of research project. And actually, I think that the best, the most important motivation in order to study higher spin theory is string theory itself. Indeed, even if string theory is a remarkable scenario that has led to a huge number of very interesting results, it is still a scheme. So it's some set of rules of which we don't know the fundamental principles yet. And so in its formulation, a lot of problems are still not clear. And I would say the most important one is background independence. So in order to try to address, to understand better a background independent formulation of string theory, the study of higher spins can be helpful. And indeed, if we look at the set of rules that come in string theory, we can see that string theory comes with the key ingredient, that is an infinite tower of higher spin, massive higher spin excitations. That is at the basis of consistency of string theory and of all the beautiful properties that are behind it. Indeed, the soft UV behavior of all amplitudes, of string amplitudes, or the open-closed dualities, the planar dualities, black hole entropy countings, and so on, all these very nice and beautiful results actually can be interpreted as an effect of the consistent tower of higher spin excitations. So in order to reiterate the point of view, let me stress that the difficulty of that we are facing now is exactly encoded somehow in the way we are defining string theory. And indeed, we are defining string theory through this quote-unquote mechanical model of the string picture. And this is an asymmetric theory. And so, since global symmetries on the asymptotic states are dual to the bulk geometry, so we are more close to the global symmetries on the boundary states than to the bulk geometry. That is what I would like to understand better higher spin theory. So let me remark at the end of this introductory slide that string theory, as I tried to convince anyway it is a consistent higher spin theory. So to try to understand string theory within this wider realm is our motivation. The structure of the plan of my talk will be more or less in three parts. The first part where I will start actually from string theory, considering string theory as a theoretical laboratory, where we can look at the higher spin interaction, and higher spin interactions that are consistent because of the string consistency. And then from these results on string amplitudes, I will have, I think, the time to present only cubic interactions in string theory. I will analyze how one can extract informations about massless higher spin interactions that are what I want to study, because the higher spin symmetry is manifest in that case. And then after, I will present the result for the cubic interaction for massless higher spin fields. And I will describe how it can be generalized, the result in flat space, to any constant curvature background by radial reduction. Then I will move from to a purely field theoretic approach if I have time. And I will describe actually this work that I have done at the end of July about endpoint functions. So I will describe the Nader procedure. I will consider basically a toy model, Young-Mills example. And then motivated by the string result, I will propose a solution for the Nader procedure at four. I will describe you at four, but this solution can generalize to n orders, and also its extension to any constant curvature background. And then I will concentrate on a simple example to understand the physics that is behind this proposal. And this is basically the spin 2 example. And then I will move to some conclusions. So let me start from string theory. And as I said, the string theory in this talk will be considered as a theoretical laboratory. So basically, we take the rules that are given. So we have this way of computing scattering amplitude, the S matrix. And actually, the rules are this integration measure. Then there are the Champaton factors. And then the vertex operators that are associated to the asymptotic states. In my talk, I will concentrate basically to the first Regge trajectory because it is a little bit simpler in order to study the first Regge trajectory, and then so leaving away the mixed symmetry states that are present into the spectrum. Anyway, there are other ingredients, actually, that are given by the rules of the game in string theory. And those are the Virasoro constraints that enforce on shell condition on the S matrix. And actually are in general, for if you consider phi to be any general string field, they are a generalized form of first Pauli condition. But for the first Regge trajectory, they come tends to be completely equivalent to the Virasoro, to the first Pauli condition for totally symmetric polarization tensors. This is the content of the first Regge trajectory. Okay, so let me now, I want to compute this object for the full first Regge trajectory. And in order to do this, let me introduce some formalism that will be very convenient. And I will stress over and over, anyway, if you have some question about this formalism in this talk, please stop me. And actually, this is called generating function techniques. It's a very slight modification of the usual operator formalism of string theory, but it can give a lot of power because you translate all problems into differential equations, basically. So the point is to encode all the polarization tensors of the first Regge trajectory into a single generating function, phi I of pi and xi I. So these two labels are only to indicate that you have a generating function in momentum space of polarization tensors in momentum space pi I. And then you have this auxiliary variable, xi I, that is nothing but a convenient simplification. So I'm considering all the alpha oscillator, I'm calling xi, where now xi are commuting variables, so ordinary variables. And all the states are encoded within this expansion of this function. Now this is a function. And you have the scalar, that is the Taquion wave function. Then you have the Gauge boson polarization tensor. Then you have the spin two polarization tensor, and so on, encoded as the coefficient of this generating function. In this setting, it's very convenient. So this, as I said, the commuting value. It's very convenient to define amplitudes in this way. And this form of the amplitudes, actually, what I'm doing, extracting, so I'm separating from the two pieces of the amplitudes, the polarization tensors on one side, and the generating function of the amplitude on the other side. Now I will introduce also this other ingredient, this star contraction. So this phi 1, phi n of xi 1, xi n, here I'm suppressing the pi, the argument about the momentum, are exactly of this kind, are these formal sums of all polarization tensors. Then Zn, as I said, is a generating function, is a function that encodes all possible scattering amplitude for any kind of generating function here. And then I contract these two objects through this star contraction that is defined in this way. So given two generating functions, depending on psi 1 and psi 1 prime, the star contraction has this effect. So take this corresponding scalar components and multiply together the corresponding spin 1 component and contract together the corresponding spin 2 component, and so on. So this is a very convenient way of describing amplitudes because all the physical information is encoded within a function. And this is somehow a simplification because some constraints become differential equations, and so on. And this is actually called Weyl-Wigner. It's a way of using, so this star product has been introduced by Weyl-Wigner, so it can be called Weyl-Wigner calculus. Now let's apply this formalism to string theory. And let us compute Zn for string theory. So that's what I want to do. I want to, within this trick this formally. I want to compute Zn for string theory. So we know the rule of the game, and actually Zn can be obtained as computing a correlation function in the CFT. So we can compute this generating function of correlation functions of the CFT, and one ends up with this result, where we have to remember the integration over the position with a measure. So anyway, we have an integration, and then this is the generating function. But actually, in order to arrive at the right generating function of scattering amplitudes, this object somehow has a huge redundancy. That is actually the redundancy of the CFT description. So the string picture, from this point of view, is equivalent to a redundancy here. And the redundancy is actually the possibility of fixing at will the position of trains of so the first three y that are the insertion positions. So that's what I was saying at the beginning in my first slide, that somehow the mechanical model hides the geometry. Indeed, we have in all these amplitudes some redundant description that has no actually target space counterpart. And so we would like to eliminate completely this redundancy and try to interpret the physics in terms of redundancy of the target space. And we can do this. So I will describe how it's possible to completely eliminate this redundancy at the level of the generating function, obtaining a generating function of all the amplitudes for the first Regge trajectory. And this is, to my knowledge, I don't know some other result of this kind. As I said, so we want to eliminate this unphysical dependence. The generating function technique gives us this possibility. And let's concentrate on three-point function. One can do this, of course, at each order, fourth order, five order, and nth order. But let's concentrate on the three-point function where there is no integration, basically. And we have to eliminate this unphysical dependence. And the way is that that unphysical dependence is related to the fact that we are off shell somehow. We have to go on shell. Because actually string theory is defined as an S-matrix theory, so an on-shell theory. And so we have to parameterize the pi p1 squared, p2 squared, p3 squared as the mass shell given by the first constraint, the first Virasoro constraint. Then we have to impose the transversality constraint that at the level of this generating function, so translates into these constraints on this auxiliary variable. And then we have the traceless, the L2 constraint that translates into this equation, Xi I dot Xi I equals zero. So enforcing this, one can actually simplify the full dependence on these three insertion position. And at the end, one recovers the generating function of amplitudes. And indeed, now I will explain what I mean by this object. But actually, this object does not have any more a dependence on the three insertion positions. And this bracket here indicates only a sign. So we know that at 3 point in field theory, we have two non-cyclic orderings. And so we can have a plus or minus. Actually, we have this P2-3 is defined as P2 minus P3. So you understand the possibility of changing sign, so changing the ordering of the external legs. And this is the only leftover dependence. So the redundancy associated to the string description has been completely eliminated. And now this is can be interpreted as a field theoretic result completely. So from this point of view, we want to concentrate on the target space redundancies and to understand those. Now, what we have to do in order to get the amplitudes is to, as I said before, we have to compute the star contraction of this generating function with the polarization tensor generating functions. And this can be done. This can be done, and one ends up with this object that is actually a very compact expression for the full scattering amplitude involving the first Regge trajectory. Now, I will try to explain what does it means by this. So here I have my generating functions. This is the first argument, P1, that indicates that it's an expansion, a formal expansion of polarization tensors. And this is the second argument. And in place of the second argument, I take this differential operator, where this d on the dxi acts, for instance, on this xi, and on this xi exactly as the usual derivative. And so computes the contractions between the polarization tensors encoded within these generating functions. So this is a very simple bookkeeping device in order to have to encode all possible scattering amplitudes for the first Lagrange trajectory. Okay, I want to mention that, as I also said before, also similar results hold for four-point amplitude, where one can eliminate completely this redundancy, and also one can proceed to higher orders. And also, I'm doing the same kind of computation in superstring theory, where one can do this kind of computation for fermions, higher spin fermions. And mixed symmetry fields are in progress and can be dealt with too, even though they are a little bit more difficult. Well, so let me now try to analyze in more details this result. So we have you have used our rules. We have obtained our set of interactions among higher spin fields. And let me try now to describe to see if one can understand something about interaction of higher spin in general now from this result. So in order to do this, I will present some example. So I will expand this full result and picking up some very simple examples, and I will try to learn what happens in these cases. So let's go to this example. The first one, the simplest one actually, is the coupling of two scalars to zero spin zero with a spin S field. Actually, if one expanded the result, of course, one they have to pick up from phi 1 and phi 2 only the scalar component. And from phi 3, one pick up only the spin S component. When by this notation, with this dot, I mean that any index of the polarization tensor phi 3 is contracted with this P12, so P1 minus P2. So I have S P1 minus P2 contracted with any index of the polarization tensor. So this is basically the result that I get in this case. But I could also, for instance, make a Fourier transform going into position space and extract the current that induces that kind of coupling. If I do this, and I restrict to this 0, 0s, so I want to look at the current made by two scalars and of spin s, I can extract a full generating function of higher spin currents from this string theory result. And the result can be summarized by this generating function. So this is again a generating function, and has two arguments. X is the space-time variable, and xi is this auxiliary variable. And so I have these are phi, the wave function of the scalar field. And in order to pick the spin one current, for instance, I have to expand this object in xi. I have to interpret this as a formal series. So I have to expand the linear ordering size, and I will read the spin one current. I have to expand the quadratic ordering size, and I will read the spin two current. So to make a simple example, I can take the complex scalar, and I have this zero term with no dependence on psi, and I can expand the linear order. I will obtain exactly the usual current of two scalars that can be used in order to make interaction with the Gibbs boson, and then I can go on and I will have all a full tower of higher spin currents. I have to mention that in this way, we recover exactly the result. So from string theory, that is a massive theory, anyway, we recover exactly the result of Berensburger and Van Damme in 1986, where they were studying currents of two scalars in a gauge theory, so where the fields were massless. So string theory uses exactly a current for massless fields. So even if the theory is massive, the currents that string theory uses in order to make interaction, this is an example, are conserved currents. So let me go to a little bit more difficult example. That is the 1-1s example. One can expand the general result I showed before, and one obtains this tower of contribution. So I have a contribution with S minus two derivatives here, a contribution with S derivatives, and a contribution with S plus two derivatives. And now one can perform some similar kind of analysis, trying to see if this kind of coupling is induced or not by a conserved current. And actually what one discovers is that this coupling too is induced by a conserved current. And now, once you have understand, and once you have understood that the coupling is induced by a conserved current, a massless limit is defined, is well defined, because the current is conserved. And you lose, in the whenever you do this, you lose, for instance, in this case, particular case, the lowest derivative contribution. So one can perform some similar kind of analysis for the full generating function. Now, these are two examples. And indeed, the gauge invariant pattern emerges from this, from the full string couplings. And one can go now, one can forget about, so we have already forgot string theory a long time ago when I have completely eliminated the Y dependence. But anyway, recognizing the currents, one can perform the massless limit, because if the current are conserved, the massless limit is consistent. And one ends up with this result that encodes the encodes coupling. These are so amplitudes with the three massless generating functions. So I have generating function of totally symmetric higher spin fields, and this object contract is a bookkeeping device for the tensor structure. So basically, the tensor structure is given by an exponential of this very, very simple function of the size. So this is the generating function of massless higher spin couplings. So I'm not here. I've not proven that this is the most general coupling. But in the next slide, when I will analyze the classification that comes out from here, I can do a, I can confront this with the known results, and actually it will turn out that this exhausts all the possibilities, this kind of structure. So what I want to remark of this nice form that is actually suggested by string theory, so an exponential of a very simple operator, a very similar structure to the one of, that comes out from string theory, but now in the massless limit, is this operator, as I said. And actually, if you analyze carefully this operator here that I'm inside the circle, you can, I can call this, I will call in the next slide, red G. It is the sum of two diagrams of this kind. And if you take this object and you change, now this Xi I's, this Xi 1, Xi 2, Xi 3, you interpret as the polarization tensor of a spin 1 field, these are exactly the Feynman rules in a theory of, so this is the Feynman rule, these three terms are the Feynman rules for the gauge boson with two scalar, and these other three are exactly the Feynman rules for three gauge bosons in ordinary Young Mills. So actually, any higher spin interaction is related to this, to Young Mills interaction that can be considered as the Lego bricks of any possible higher spin cubic interactions. So this is so this coupling can be recast, can be resummed in this very nice form, where everything can be related to Young Mills. What I want to mention is that of course, these are amplitudes, and they are gauge invariant up to linearized mass shell, massless linearized massless equation of motions. But not only that, the off-shell completion is uniquely fixed, up to, of course, partial integration and field definition, but it's uniquely fixed once you have chosen the field content. And if you analyze the deformation of this kind of coupling on the linearized gauge symmetry, you discover that among this coupling, not all deform, but among this coupling, there are some couplings that deform the abelian gauge symmetry. So now let me, I understand this is a very compact way of writing these couplings. Let me now describe you more closely what is, what comes out from this result, so all the possibilities. So analysis of all the possibilities, and this analysis will tell us that this is the most general object. Very important thing, let me mention that from at this point, I came out with exponential function. But if I take this object in a general field theory, this exponential is completely arbitrary. I have a huge arbitrarily between couplings with fixed number of derivatives and fixed spin. Each of these couplings is gauge invariant by itself at a cubic level, and one can play with this coupling function in, from a field theory perspective at will. So it's a very interesting problem to try to understand how this coupling function can be fixed. And actually, there are various ways in order to do that. One is to look at higher orders. But also, since now this is a flat space, of course, but if you go to ADS, as I will describe in the next few slides, One way could be to fix this coupling by ADS-CFT, using ADS-CFT correspondence. Anyway, let me mention these things after, but I want to stress that even though from string theory you have this set of this exponential, in general, there is a huge ambiguity from the field theory point of view. So you can have a lot of higher spin theories from this point of view. Maybe only a few of them are consistent. That's, of course, the point. So as I said, let me make the analysis of the cubic vertex. The general cubic vertex involving S1, S2, and fields is of this form. I have K1 derivatives acting on the fields of spin S1, K2 acting on the field of spin S2, and so on. So I can, now, and you remember, I defined a red G that was the sum of two pieces. Let me split red G into two black G. So here I'm considering this only the term that was cubic in the symbols. While the other object, the formalism is clear, but anyway, I tell you that the other G, the other part of red G, its effect is to contract the leftover indices that are not contracted by this black G with derivatives. So in order to count derivatives, what I have to do is to only to analyze this black G, so the part cubic in the symbols. So expanding the exponential, I can have terms with no black G. And these terms with no black G will have all the indices of the fields, because only black G makes contraction between indices. We'll have all the indices of the fields contracted with derivatives. So how many indices, free indices I have? S1 plus S2 plus S3. So I will have S1 plus S2 plus S3 derivatives. And in the spin one case, the coupling that I get is this one, A1 dot P23, where I always use this definition. And it's actually the first term of the expansion of F cube, of the term F cube. Now I can act one time with G, with this black G. So I will eliminate, so black G is also linear in derivatives, but subtracts three indices. So subtract three indices and contracts only one with the derivative. So subtracts three derivative and adds one. So S1 plus S2 plus S3 minus two. So I have a coupling when I act once with G, with this black G, of S1 plus S2 plus S3 minus two derivatives. And this is actually the Young-Mills coupling, where I contract two of the polarization tensors, and the other is contracted with the derivative. And then I can go on applying this black G more times. But since I will anytime subtract one index from all the fields, at some point, the lowest spin field will complete the number of indices, and I will end with zero, with nothing. That's the point. So I can go on, but if S3 is the minimum spin, so if I have S1, S2, S3, and S3 is the minimum spin, I cannot apply G more than S3 times, because I will exhaust all the indices of one of the three fields. And so keep going. So subtracting minus two, minus two, minus two, and arriving at this level, I will end up with the lowest derivative coupling in flat space that contains S1 plus S2, minus S3 indices, minus S3 derivatives. And this is the minimum number of derivatives that we have. So if we confront this classification with the Metzaev classification obtained some years ago, a few years ago, we exactly see the same kind of structure. So we can conclude that the expression I wrote before, that is a function of these Lego bricks obtained by Young-Mills, exhausts all the possibilities. And moreover, I want to comment that this classification contains actually the solution to all possible no-go theorems that have been considered at, only the Weinberg theorem is not taken into account here, because the Weinberg theorem is something that applies to higher orders. But why? For instance, a lot of no-go theorems that have been cooked up for in flat space for higher spin have been concentrating on the minimal coupling. For instance, Weinberg-Witten theorem and many other theorems, also this other result by Porrati, more recent result by Porrati. And the point is that if you count the number of derivatives, for instance, for the gravitational coupling of a spin three fields, so in that case, you have a vertex with 3, 3, 2, spin 3, spin 3, spin 2. And so you have 3 plus 3, 6, minus 2, 4. So this means that you cannot write and minimal coupling, so a coupling with two derivatives in the case of spin 3. Only multipolar coupling are possible. And this kind of classification makes also statements about multipolar couplings that cannot be always possible. So you cannot always write, given S1, S2, S3, a coupling with a given number of derivatives. That's basically the point. And so from this point of view, you can regard this kind of structure as a generalization of the Weinberg-Witten theorem that applies to any possible multipolar coupling. Well, now that I described the structure encoded within this exponential of this G, and this is flat space gauge invariance, flat space cubic vertex, let me describe you how one can extend this result to ADS, to any, not only ADS, yes, any constant curvature background. Actually, there is a trick. And the trick consists into an embedding. Yes? The vertex somehow is the same. The starting point, the starting Z, actually is, apart from the ghosts, is exactly the cubic vertex that you use usually in string field theory.
So, I mean, this diamond diagram that we did.
Yeah, the cubic.
The sub product of the field.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. So as I was saying, that you can consider ADS or DS as some embedded surfaces within an ambient flat space. That's the idea, basically. And with this ambient space formulation, one can really make an isomorphism that was done long ago by Fronsdal between flat space. Flat ambient space fields, higher spins, and DS, EDS or ADS fields. Actually, the isomorphism is really very simple, and on generating function, one has to impose constraints on the ambient space fields. One constraint is this tangential constraint of the generating function. So this operator, these differential operators, take one index of this phi and contracts with x. So it's imposing tangentiality of the field with respect to the constant radius surface. And then we have an homogeneity condition with respect to the radial coordinate. And the parameter of homogeneity is this dimension, is delta. If we impose these two conditions, one has an exact isomorphism between degrees of freedom. So one is simply rewriting the degrees of freedom of ADS fields in terms of flat space, ambient space fields, ambient space fields. So it's only a change of coordinates somehow. But the degrees of freedom are the same, and one can look at their interaction from the flat space point of view, from ambient space point of view. The only problem is that if we integrate in D plus one dimension, since we have fixed an homogeneity condition with respect to the radial dependence of the field, if we integrate on the radial coordinate, we will get diverging integrals. That's the only problem. But can be solved very easily with this delta function insertion that makes this measure exactly a d-dimensional measure, not a d plus one dimensional measure. What's the difference now? While before, so we now have to integrate our vertex with this measure. But if we integrate our vertex with this measure, we cannot anymore integrate by parts. That's the only difficulty with respect to the flat space one. So we have to find more counter terms that cancel the gauge value. When you consider the word identities of the cubic coupling or the gauge variation, the Nader procedure, we have to find more counter terms that cancel the delta prime, delta second, delta third contributions that are generated when you integrate by parts, and the derivative, the total derivative, acts with this on this delta function. So actually, since the gauge invariance of the AES fields can be rewritten exactly as the gauge invariance of the ambient space field, really this actually is a shorthand notation for the usual gauge invariance. So delta phi. This object can be rewritten in this symbol formalism in this way, as this operator acting on the generating function of all the gauge parameters. So basically, one what one has to do is to fix the total derivative part of the vertex. And we have done that together with this postdoc in Scuola Normale. And so at the end, the only change of the structure of the vertex, there is always this exponential of this red G. But what changes is the addition of this term proportional to dx, where dx is the total derivative. And actually, if you compute the exponential of this object, it's actually a resummation of the full counter term proportional to the total derivative that ensures the gauge invariance of the vertex. So if you use exponential of this object integrated with this measure, you have completed the systematic of ADS or DS cubic vertices. And actually, this trick is very general, and you can use it also at higher orders. And makes also, so we have basically moved the problem of interactions to flat space interaction, to consistent flat space interaction. Any ADS theory can be written in terms of this ambient space technique. And the Nader procedure, so the consistency of the theory, is exactly the same as the consistency of the flat space interaction. So let me mention also how one can recover from this result I presented for ADS couplings, the usual ADS couplings in terms of intrinsic ADS quantities. And what indeed one observed that the lower derivative tail of couplings appear from this. I have described a coupling that contains a fixed number of derivatives in flat space, in the ambient space, fixed number of derivatives. But fixed number of derivatives from the point of view of ambient space is not the same as fixed number of covariant derivatives in ADS. Indeed, one has to do the change of variable, so one has to split the radial dependence from the ADS dependence, from the ADS dependence, and then a derivative with respect to x will split in this way. And also the symbol, the ambient space symbol, so this auxiliary variable will split into the symbol related to the indices leaving on ADS and the symbol related to the radial indices. In this way, you see the appearance of this 1 over L, this L dependence. So you will have, of course, an highest derivative term where all the derivatives are replaced by covariant derivatives. But you will have also a tail of lower derivative contributions that will come with power of 1 over L to some power in order to compensate the dimension. And so you will really get the minimal coupling in ADS. But the minimum, so you lower the derivatives, so start from some coupling with some number of derivatives, you will lower the derivatives, and you at some point will reach two derivatives. And actually you will think, I found the minimal coupling. But somehow that interpretation is not so precise, I would say, because the full coupling, only the full tower of coupling, is gauge invariant with respect to the, so it's consistent with respect to the higher spin gauge symmetry. So even what you would call minimal coupling in ADS is in really some non-minimal coupling, because it's a full tower of fields and is encoded within a coupling that, from the flat space point of view, contains a fixed number of derivatives. Indeed, this is basically what I said, that the L3, the cubic term of the Lagrangian, splits as this object. And now one can make an analogy between what I have presented you from the point of view of string theory and a flat limit of this kind of deformed vertices. Indeed, whenever I consider the flat limit here, some lower derivative coupling disappear exactly on the same, in very similar way to what I described in string theory, where some lower derivative coupling disappear because the current is a conserved current. And so at the end, one recovers only the highest derivative terms of this tail, only some highest derivative terms. Of course, you can have more than one AN. So you can recover all the leading AN. As I said, similar logic. And in this way, one can have some chance to understand better Basilev's system that is formulated in a very different language. But from this point of view, one can try to analyze it. The only thing that is missing at this moment is the choice of the coupling function that corresponds to the Basilev system. Once we have understood the choice of the coupling function that corresponds to the Basilev system, we have completed, so it's somehow it's equivalent to have done the, to have transformed, to go from the frame-like description of Basilev system to a metric-like description of the Basilev system. It's exactly this. But we have to fix the cubic.
Pascaliere is two orders. It's not cubic, is it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's quartic.
But now I will describe how one can go to quartic and how one can go to... So one can have the perturbative expansion of a Pascaliere system. Of course, you can consider cubic, and then you can compute scattering numbers and so on. So this is only the cubic part of the story. There is also the higher part of the story that I hope I can conclude in 20 minutes.
Are you finding just one possible cubic vertex?
What I think is that there is only one possible cubic vertex because you have to fix the coupling function. Naively, you would have more cubic vertices in the bulk. S1 plus S2 plus S3 derivatives, S1 plus S2 plus S3 minus 2, and so on. But what should happen is that only a particular coupling function, so a particular combination of all these different derivative couplings will be consistent.
Well, I think we know that there should be, for example, in ADS4, there are at least two inequivalent cubic couplings, which are both consistent.
Indeed, I know this. First, from the point of view of the CFT. So if you go...
Well, also from the point of view of Vasilev system, there are two...
If you analyze Vasilev, indeed, what I want to do now is to match, what is the project that I'm doing now, is to match to compute the boundary, since these are coupling in ADS, to compute with, starting from this object, the boundary correlator of three currents, three higher spin currents in the CFT, and matching the coupling function in the bulk with the result that we know on the boundary CFT, one can fix this coupling function, so obtaining basically only one, so all the few possibilities.
Can you say again what was the coupling function?
The coupling function, here I can go back to the slide. Maybe I can simply write. So when I started there is this exponential of G acting on the fields. And here there is the star contraction. This function is arbitrary from the point of view of field theory. So I started from string theory. Now I want to apply, this is a result from massless fields. It's completely general, so I can play with this function. But what are the possible functions that are completely consistent with only totally symmetric fields and so on ADS, for instance. I would like to find what are the consistent functions. And only one function will be consistent. You can see this consistency in the bulk physics because not all possible choice for the function can be consistent with higher orders, for instance. Or there are other global symmetries that fix this coupling function at the cubic level.
Well, maybe we can discuss later, but I think there should be at least two consistent ones in four dimensions.
So, okay, but I want to compute those two. So I agree that there is some constraint. Not all functions are good. I completely agree with this point.
There is no mismatch. Okay, where I was?
Okay, so now let me move to higher orders. To explain how this kind of analysis generalizes at higher orders. I will restrict the attention to the four points, but actually the strategy applies to all orders. And actually, in order to do this, I want to move from a more field theoretic approach. So Nader procedure, just Nader procedure, analyzing the most general solution to Nader procedure that is exactly equivalent to enforce, I will make this more clear in detail, to word identities. So what is Nader procedure? Nader procedure is what I would call a perturbative approach to geometry, to the geometry of the space-time. Indeed, it's you take your Lagrangian, you expand in term quadratic in the fields, cubic in the fields, quartic in the fields, and so on. You do the same with the gauge transformation. And then you ask, so you want that the Lagrangian is gauge invariant. So the free part, you start with the spectrum of fields. So you choose what fields you are describing. And of course, the free part of the Lagrangian is if you want the Lorentz symmetry. So if you know what are the representations that you are studying, should be something that is phi box phi. And if you want massless fields, your gauge invariant at zero order should be the usual gauge invariant. And then you want to deform this kind of theory. And this is what I call geometry. So geometry would be the resummation. Very, very difficult, the summation of this structure. Actually, if you start from a spin 2, only spin 2, this kind of procedure will recover completely Einstein-Hilbert action, full Einstein-Hilbert action. Of course, to go from here to the Einstein Hilbert action, there is this very complicated resummation. But everything is encoded here. So the solution, so what I'm going to do is to find a solution to this order by order. So the first equation, if you plug this delta within L, will give you delta 1 over 2 plus delta 0 over 3 equals 0. So how do you interpret this equation? So okay, let me go on. So then you go also this equation. This is a second order. And then you would say, okay, this equation, I have to understand a logic in order to solve one equation and so on, and have a full solution order by order. The point is that any delta of L2 will be proportional to box, and box are the field equations. So basically, the first equation is an equation for L3 and nothing else at the first step. And it is exactly that the linearized gauge variation, this one, of the cubic coupling is zero on shell. But then I can plug, once I found all the possibilities for L3, I can plug back L3. I can look at what is proportional to the equation of motion, and this will give me delta 1. Then I can plug delta 1 here, and I can interpret again this equation as an equation for L4, because this is proportional to equation of motion. And once I found L4, I can solve for delta 2, and then I can go on. So basically, I will find all this tower, and then I will find this other tower. But what happens is that if you want to solve this at the quartic order, there is some more complication, because the equation is not anymore it's not anymore an homogeneous equation. This is delta 0, L3 equals 0. There is no known term. Here we will start to have these non-homogeneous contributions here that are terms that we know from the previous step of the Noether procedure. And what I will analyze in more details is the meaning of this tower of non-homogeneous contribution, and how one can interpret this in a physical way, very simple physical way actually, and one can give a solution of the full tower equation. So this seems to be increasingly complicated, but at the end is not. There is a clear logic behind this. So I want to remind you symbol calculus, because it will be a basic ingredient in order to make this analysis. Actually, symbol calculus makes simpler things because it translates Noether procedure into a set of differential equations. And the differential equations, we know very well how to solve. So again, the simplification, for instance, in the case of Young Mills, is that instead of using a mu, I use these auxiliary variables. So I use generating functions, and at the end, I work with functions, generating functions, scattering amplitude, and only at the end, I contract the corresponding components with the corresponding polarization tensors. So these are commuting auxiliary variables. In the case of Young Mills, very simple. So for instance, let me have only Young Mills polarization tensor and a scalar wave function. Okay, this is the full generating function of amplitudes. So this is the formal sum of all amplitudes. So I have the sum of the amplitudes with one Young Mills, one gauge boson and a two scalar, plus the amplitude with three gauge boson. And I split the polarization tensors from the generating function with the help of this star product. So as I said, this is the formal sum. And to make an example, for instance, if I want to encode this tensor structure, so P1 contracted with A3 and the contraction of A1 and A2, I can rewrite, so this object, this usual contraction, can be rewritten in terms of this, where I have basically at the Young-Mills level, when we work with gauge boson, this is exactly this substitution. But the power of this substitution is very simple also for higher spins. That's the point. I remind you the form of the contraction, that is this that is encoded by this differential operator acting on the generating function. And then, as I said, I want to remember, I want to recall the form of the scattering amplitude, where now these are full generating function of higher spin fields. This is the generating function of the amplitudes, and this is the object that I have here. So this formula is generalized. So now, in the following slides, I will restrict the attention to the Young-Mills case. And then the generalization will come very, very, very quickly at the end, along these lines. So let me consider this case where we completely know the answer, but actually if we analyze this case in this point, from this point of view, we understand that this answer is the answer for all possible spins. So let me start with a very simplified setting where I impose transversality on the Gauge boson. And so my quadratic Lagrangian is simply the sum of the box of the field. So A can be also a colored field. So let me solve the first equation of the Noether procedure. So since I'm using this symbol formalism, this generating function formalism, basically delta zero becomes a differential operator. So it eliminates one xi and it puts a p, a momentum, and makes exactly, so encodes exactly the action of this gauge variation. So basically, this equation becomes this differential equation. So I have an object, L3, that depends on psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, and want to find the most general object of this kind that satisfies this differential equation. This is exactly equivalent to the first equation of the Noether procedure. So the cubic, let us notice that this is homogeneous. So homogeneous differential equation. So you have a differential equation equal to zero. Now, as we have learned from string theory, we know the solution. I've already given you a solution for this object here that satisfies this equation. And actually is L3. So you remember the exponential of red G. But from this point of view, we see the ambiguity that comes in at this level from purely Noether procedure. So purely Noether procedure will give you here an arbitrary function of these four building blocks that all separately satisfy this equation. So but that's the ambiguity, but actually this is an ambiguity of this constraint, but that will be completely fixed. And that's the next step I'm working on. So I just to mention what are the single building blocks and the full ambiguity of the result as solved by purely Noether process, so purely field theory on flat space gives this full result. Now let me move to, so as I said, once we know L3, we can compute delta 1. And once we compute delta 1, we can go and solve the next equation. But what we get now is the differential equation equal to some on shell, of course, equal to some known term. So it's a non-homogeneous equation, a little bit difficult to solve. But what is the logic behind this non-homogeneous contribution? That's what I'm going to talk. As being this non-homogeneous equation, one can split the solution in two parts. One as a solution of the particular equation, one particular solution of the particular equation, and another that is a solution of the homogeneous equation. This is very much similar to the equation that I solved at the cubic level of the Noether procedure. But the general solution for L4 will be the sum of a particular solution plus a general homogeneous solution. The logic of this particular solution is that a solution of this particular equation is always minus the current exchange. So one can really, the meaning of this equation from the physical point of view is that this L particular is always minus the current exchange. So once one notices this, and the current exchange is completely specified once one knows L3 at the cubic level, the only thing so what's left to solve is the same kind of equation that we've solved at the cubic level. And actually, this is really expected somehow. This equation is nothing more than enforcing the word identities of the various endpoint functions. So now I will describe you how one can solve this object. So the whole Noether procedure has been reduced to the same kind of equation. So at any order, one has to solve only this equation. And L4 will be given here, since we know the solution of all particular equations that we have written. Young-Mills case is very simple, but it's only since it is so simple, Young-Mills case, you will understand. So L particular is exactly minus the current exchange contribution, where since we have color ordering, we have only two channels. While L-homogeneous, what it is exactly the amplitude that satisfies the word identities. At the end, we have to sum those two contributions. And what will happen in Young Mills is that in order to sum them consistently, the non-local part has to cancel. And at the end, we will remain only with the L4 coupling. But this kind of approach will give you the solution for all higher spin couplings at all orders. And see, with the trick of the ambient space formulation, we'll give you the higher spin couplings at all orders in all constant curvature backgrounds. So let us see what happens. What is the generalization? So Young Mills is very simple, but what is the generalization for higher spin? And now we will see also all the obstruction that were encountered by the Nogo theorems, for instance, the Weinberg theorem of 1964. So let me repeat the logic at the cubic level. Cubic level, we have Young Mills Lego brick. There is this red G, and the solution to the Nader procedure is a function of this red G. So something analogous happened for higher spin. So we have to solve this equation. This is the solution of the homogeneous equation. It's not the coupling, but the most general solution of this equation is still a function of the Young Mills object. That is still a Lego brick of all possible Young Mills of all possible higher spin amplitudes. So of course now this is a formal sum. We can play with Mandelson variable. There are some, anyway, the basic tensor structure are all encoded within this generating function. And I can call this object SU G1234, where G1234 is exactly the amplitudes of Young Mills multiplied by SU in order to not have poles. Because I want a single pole object by consistency with other S-matrix theories and so on. So basically, we have recovered the full, and this generalized at any orders. One can cook up some exponential at any orders like of this form. And this is the full solution of this encodes the full solution of Nader procedure. So in the last 5 minutes, I will try to explain what's the meaning of this result in the case of spin 2. So I will analyze four spin 2 scattering, four spin 2 coupling, what happens. So let me expand that formula and for spin 2. And we have two possibilities, because whenever you consider Young Mills, so any amplitude in field theory at 4 points, you know that the possible non-cyclic orderings now are so independent, because for G1, 2, 3, they were the same up to a sign. Here, instead, we have really two independent objects, G1234 and G2134. So we can have two possibilities. One planar example that is exactly the square of the Young Mills one, and a non-planar example that is of this kind. One multiplied, so all these legs are contracted with symbols. So at the end, I have to take A, this is generating function, and make the star product with polarization tensors. But these are generating functions. So all the, I can, these are functions. I can take the square, the cube, anything. And this resembles more open string, because you can put some pattern factors here. And this is more closed string-like. So let us analyze now what the difference between these two outcomes. And in order to do this, let's look at the pole part. There will be some local piece, and there will be a pole part. These are amplitudes. So I want to analyze the pole. So if I expand this result, the first that was open string like, I will have only these two pole parts. This will have a single pole and it will be two channels. So this is recall you the fact that this kind of object is color ordered. And instead, if I analyze the other one, well, the one that was non-planar, closed string like, I can get only this object here. Now let's count. Let's see what is the spin that is propagating here. So the residue of this pole. And we can recognize this residue. But actually, these are the only possibilities that comes out that are consistent with Nader procedure. So we can read the exchanged particles. In this case, since this is, remember, this is Young Mills cubic coupling, where the polarization tensor has been replaced by this auxiliary variable. So this leg has one derivative. This leg too has one derivative. So I have one Mandelson variable here. One Mandelson variable squared. and then a pole 1 over s. So the residue is one Mandelson variable squared. And this is exactly a spin 2 propagating. So this amplitude you can interpret as the gravitational 4-point amplitude, because you have two external spin 2 and inside you are propagating a spin 2. This is exactly the gravitational amplitude. Instead, let's analyze the first. In this case, we have one momentum here, one Mandelson variable, but another Mandelson variable, u. So we have two Mandelson variables squared, and then we have this u that cancels, one of the u. So we have three Mandelson variables on the residue. And three Mandelson variables is only a spin 3 exchange, And indeed, we have this kind of structure. So this kind of amplitude is consistent only with the full tower of higher spins, because it's saying you that you have to put inside higher spins, and the couplings that will be associated to this amplitude will be coupling that involves higher spins when you subtract the current exchanges. And this other will be exactly the gravitational one. So massless spin 2 is not necessarily gravity whenever you consider higher spins. Of course, when you eliminate higher spins, there is only gravity. But if you take into account also higher spin, there are more options. And indeed, this option that is more closely related to the massive spin 2 excitation of open strings, and actually is very closely related to Vasilev system, because in Vasilev system, we can add colors, so we can add some pattern factors. This is not gravity. But I want to mention that there is a crucial difference between these two objects, that if you make the computation of the couplings, Lagrangian couplings associated to these amplitudes, we will discover no localities. And basically, you will have at the Lagrangian level, I'm finishing, at the Lagrangian level, you will have 1 over box. But what happens now if you use the ambient space trick in order to read this 1 over box on ADS? So in order to make really the comparison between Vasilev and this, you will obtain that the 1 over box in d plus 1 dimensions will split as 1 over box minus some mass term proportional to the cosmological constant. And you, of course, are able to re-express this as a series of low or perturbatively local contribution. But this object is exactly a 1 over box non-locality. So Vasilev's system contains exactly the non-localities that can be extracted from this kind of couplings here that I've presented. So are the same non-locality. Only the fact that since you have lambda, you are relating rigidly the non-locality to this parameter, to the radius of EDS. But that's a non-locality, and you have to deal with that. So let me go very fast here. So the non-locality basically happens because whenever you don't have here, this is the full object that satisfies the homogeneous equation. Whenever this object cannot factorize on all possible fields, you will have the V4 is non-local. Contains this 1 over box that I mentioned. And indeed, the point is that here you have the full current exchange. So you have really everything. If you cannot cancel everything, some non-locality coming from here will still remain. But the amplitude are completely single pole. You are not adding, with this non-locality, you are not modifying the pole structure of your amplitude. So non-local 4-point couplings at the Lagrangian level are the only possible way out, so the only possible way to solve Weinberg argument that was hiddenly formulated with the hypothesis of locality of the Lagrangian, even if it was a theorem, an S-matrix theorem. It had this hidden hypothesis of local Lagrangian. But if you avoid this hidden hypothesis, you can really overcome also the Weinberg argument 1964. And you go to this with something that we really still don't know, but we can explore, non-local geometry. It will be this background-independent formulation of higher spin theories that can give us hints about string theory. Really, I finished my time. What I want to say is that the form, the structure of these non-localities forces is really the motivation that you need infinitely many higher spins. So why higher spin? Why Vasilev's theory has to contain infinitely many higher spins? Because whenever you have a non-locality like this, so if you interact 2, 2, 2, 2 at the external legs, you discover that there is a spin 3. So you can compute an amplitude with 3 spin 3. But whenever you compute an amplitude with 3 spin 3, you will have some spin 4 or higher inside. And so in order to make a consistent theory, you have to you require a full tower of higher spins. So that's actually the way you can see this from this point of view. Let me go to the conclusion. I'm finishing. So I've described all three-point couplings. The string theory has been removed from the very beginning and is actually an ambiguity and redundant description of the target space physics, but is not the one that is more that makes more manifest geometry. Four-point function has been recovered, and also this generalized to n-point function. So one can really have a perturbative definition of a Vasilev system. And then also systematic of ADS couplings for flat space analysis that have been done. What is behind the corner is a full systematic or consistent coupling function, because actually not all coupling functions are consistent. And there are constraints from the fourth order to the cubic order. So what I present is a little bit more general. One can constrain the coupling function and recover only the consistent theories. So full systematic of higher spin theories. And for the near future, there is a computation of all. So one has to, we have still to conclude the computation of n-point function on ADS. We have to compute the boundary, this boundary term in the case of n-point functions. We have to compute the coupling function of Vasilev system that will be one coupling function. And we can do this using ADS CFT. And loop computation can also be done with this formula, because we have cubic, we have quartic, we can really compute loops, and we can see how mass generation or quantum properties of higher spin theories can be so appear. And actually, as I mentioned also in the last slide, this interesting issue understanding this non-local geometry. So I finished. Sorry for 5 minutes.
So you talked about the action that you get being non-local. Is it also true that the equations of motion, if you were to do this as a classical limit, would also be non-local?
Yeah.
So suppose you tried to formulate this as a classical theory in an arbitrary curved space, not just in ADS. How well defined is it? Or, you know, because how well defined are these non-local terms in the equations of motion?
So the point is that the solution of this equation of motion will usually be, so they and when you solve this equation of motion, you will discover that the non-localities will be related to non-localities of the geometry that you are considering. That's what I expect.
I'm asking, aren't the equations of motion even well defined in general? I mean, there's bound, when you say 1/box, what does that actually mean? Is it a retarded Green's function? Is it an advanced Green's function? Is it a Feynman Green's function? Or is it something more general than that?
The way I define here is starting from the amplitude. So you have this Mandelson variable. So 1/box is never 1/0. It's 1/ some Mandelson variable. So it's a restrict type of non-locality. Of course, this is a problem. So how to really well define something like this. But Vasilev equations are non-local exactly like this, and are a way of making this system these non-localities consistent. So the way you formulate Vasilev's equation actually is a solution to what you are asking for. One example. So you should add the auxiliary fields somehow, and you can really make a clear definition of what you
have. I don't know anything about Vasilev system. Did you talk? Because I was in another seminar.
Vasilev's system is a consistent set of equations that describes interaction of these fields. So what I'm doing is to rewriting this set of equations written in a completely different formalism in this metric-like point of view.
So does Vasilev's system work in an arbitrary geometry then?
Yes, completely background independent. Yes.
And it's non-local?
Yes. Because it contains infinitely many fields. And if you integrate them out, what I'm saying is the amplitude from the metric-like point of view will display this kind of non-locality, the same system.
So but that system is local, is it? Was the infinitely many fields?
No, it's non-local.
So how does it resolve this question of defining does it not have things like 1/box minus?
In the way, so you don't see the 1/box because you can expand. So
Can you just maybe give an example of some some equation of motion in the Vesalius system, just to see how
they
it
are
work.
Formulated? They are formulated in very compact way, and you don't, so it basically is the generalization of the Weyl-Cartan formulas. You have a big differential that acts on some generating function that contains many auxiliary fields. So basically, you this one-over box can be eaten having auxiliary fields, and you will see a local theory. In terms of more fields.
But it's local.
It is a local.
It's local when you have.
It's local.
No, it does not contain one over box. Contains only perturbative no locality. It contains terms with the higher order, the higher derivatives as much as you want, if you expand.
It's an infinite number of local terms.
Yeah.
In that sense, it's not
but
local.
It's not local. Still not local. So it's still the same kind of no locality.
So then there'll be issues of convergence of all those. Did you say it's all
the issue of convergence will have a clear answer on solutions when you, so you have to, of course, they are very tricky points. I understand. So I don't think that there is a complete understanding.
I'm sorry to ask about this simple question. But, I mean, does someone have an exact solution of
yes
of these
solutions? Yes. There are exact solutions. Well, there are, I can give you reference. I'm not expert of exact solution of a Vesalius system because I don't work from that point of view, but there are kind of black hole solutions, and there are many also other kind of solution that whose interpretation is much difficult to understand. So there are solutions, maybe the interpretation of them is not clear, but there are. And in three dimensions where things simplifies, you can really cook up, the, for instance, the BTZ black hole. And you can see what are more clearly, maybe, the physical properties of this solution from Vesalius system.
So there's some sort of deformed BTZ black hole.
Yeah.
That's a solution of the Vesalius system.
Yeah, with higher spin charges.
So Simone, you said that Vesalius has two different choices. So how does he find those two choices?
How do you define? I mean, there is.
So you use
Vesalius equations are not unique. There is a choice of a function inside the equations.
It's a function.
It's a function. If you impose a parity symmetry, then this function can only have two choices.
No,
the reason why you expect two is that in a three-dimensional we know in three dimensions there are two CFTs which have higher spin symmetry, which are free bosons and free fermions. They have different three-point functions. So you expect at least two different three-point couplings.
No, but are you saying that the other ones are inconsistent? If you have parity is broken?
No.
Oh,
you can have,
if you drop parity, then you have a zoom
other
of possible. In principle,
but it's not that you have an argument that those are inconsistent quantum mechanics.
No,
I don't.
There might be a free functions where yes, different.
But these are the functions these are the functions that preserves the higher spin symmetry. So for that choice of the coupling function, you will have full higher spin symmetry in the bulk. Some other choices could break this symmetry.
Well, in ABS4, higher spin symmetry is preserved for an arbitrary function. There is a choice of one function. If you want to impose parity, then this function only collapses to two possibilities. But
if you want to study massive theories with massive higher spins in ABS, there can be other possibilities. If you want to have massless higher spin in ABS.
No, yes, of course.
What I'm saying. So you are saying that you want full higher spin symmetry in ABS4. And of course, the coupling function has to be constrained. And the Vesalius system, so I want to find the corresponding of Vesalius system.
No, but he's saying the opposite.
No,
yes. Vesalius says that it's an arbitrary function.
So Vesalius classical equations have exact higher spin symmetry for an arbitrary choice of one function. So there is an infinite family of Vesalius.
So I want, okay, so yeah.
Then people usually impose parity, then you only have two models, which usually called type A and type B.
And so I was knowing these two models where you impose parity. That's what aware of. And I want to understand what is the counterpart of this. Because since Vesalius system is formulating these frame-like formalism, This is metric-like. So I want to find the corresponding metric-like description of the same.
What do you mean by frame-like?
You
said that a couple of times.
It's a frame-like
it's
is
field bind instead of field.
Yeah,
oh.
you that's the way in which a serial system is formulated.
I see. But from that, you get the metric immediately.
Yes. Of course, there are problems in the frame-like because you can have also you have to require non-invertible. So there is also possibility to have non-invertible field, but then you have to so somehow the possibility of going back to the metric-like is crucial.
You don't want degenerate metrics
yeah.
or degenerate inverse metrics.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Yeah. Is anything known about stability of any of these? System.
I would say that it's not so clear. At least my knowledge of a serial system.
Or in your framework, can you say something about stability?
Or the solutions?
Yeah.
Only in three dimensions, but in three dimensions it's a little bit more trivial. In four dimensions it's much more interesting, but it's still unclear the interpretation of the solution. So there are conjectures about the black hole solution. What is the black hole? So I would say I honestly can't answer.
Does anyone? I guess I wouldn't even know how to ask this in your version, but in the Vasiliev version, if I understand, it's local with an infinite number of fields.
Yes.
Can you write down a Cauchy initial value problem? I mean,
The initial value problem is formulated in a very complicated way within this unfolding formulation. So you basically put initial value only on a point, and you have an infinite. Yes, because you rewrite the example I can write to you is the rewriting of the box phi equals zero.
That's pretty deterministic.
But you have an infinitely many constraints, you recover. Basically, Vasiliev system rewrites some second-order equation in terms of a first-order equation. But how it does that? So you have the mu phi equals some auxiliary field, phi mu. Then you have the mu phi mu equals some phi mu nu, and so on. Then you impose traceless condition, and then you recover box. But you have this, so these are all linear and fixed on one point. And then you recover the full dynamics by this constraint on these infinitely many equations, first order. That's the way.
I still don't understand. Suppose I wanted to. What's the right?
So
amount
if you make this make so this is the it continues. Then you have to say that this is traceless.
Yeah.
Time new is traceless.
Yeah.
And this will be.
This will be. Yeah.
So it's a cost on an infinitely many. So you have introduced infinitely many auxiliary fields.
Yeah.
And then you recover.
Right, but what's the initial data that you need to specify in order to?
So the initial data is, so once you have solved this equation, this system, this full system, makes you to recover the field phi at some shifted point, because all these are the component of the Taylor series. And so if you specify, so I'm trying to remember the logic. I'm not really an expert of Vasiliev. But this is the logic that you can, since you have, you can recover the phi in each point within an interval, because you have all this tower of, so you can hold the full tower,
like
the full Taylor series.
Looks like what you're doing is assuming that phi should be a holomorphic function, and then you can specify it by all its derivatives at one point.
Yeah.
That's really quite different from the usual.
But this is the way.
I think it has nothing to do with theory. Well, maybe it's related somehow, but it's not the same thing.
That's what I don't like of a Vasiliev system somehow, that is formulated in this way. And there, somehow it's equivalent to say that a function and it's specified, an analytic function is specified by all its derivative in a point. It's very, very similar.
Right. But in the Cauchy problem, you don't need to analytic data. There's plenty of data compact support, for example. And then you can talk about the speed of propagation, you know, whether or not it's whether it's compatible with relativity.
But that's why it's very difficult to interpret Cauchy horizons in this theory. So why it's still not clear what is the black hole solution, what if there is an horizon or not. because of
are
this
there type. Characteristic surfaces for this wave?
It's not easy. So this is the problem, somehow the problem. If, because of this trick, Vasiliev has been able to build a theory that proving that it's consistent at the classical level. But the interpretation of the theory is really difficult. That's what I can say.